From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Recently, the European Union freed its member states to make their own decisions on whether to grow genetically modified crops. And that has renewed interest in the debate over GM crops, and Iowa has much at stake in the debate. Today, we continue our look at GMOs with a focus on Iowa and the science and production of GM crops. My guests, the 2001 World Food Prize laureate, Per Pinstrup Anderson, William Beavis of the Plant Sciences Institute at Iowa State University, also a number of Iowa farmers who will give their perspective on the ground in the fields. What's at stake for Iowa in the debate over GMOs? That's after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us over the noon hour. And today we continue our look at genetically modified organisms, commonly called GMOs, and GM crops and the impact they are having here in Iowa. Recently, the European Union freed its 27 member states to make their own decisions on whether to grow genetically modified crops. The U.S. says it opposes the decision. U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk suggested the EU's proposal would complicate efforts to end a years-long dispute over U.S. food imports to that continent. Arguably, Iowa has one of the biggest stakes in the debate over genetically modified crops. Our state was home to Norman Borlaug, father of the so-called Green Revolution and founder of the World Food Prize. Iowa is a hub of biotechnology research at companies like Pioneer Hybrid and at educational institutions like Iowa State University. And Iowa ranks third in U.S. agricultural production. So what do these stakeholders see as the promise or the pitfalls of GMOs? Let's begin by finding out about the science of GMOs, how they work. And joining us to do that from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames, Professor Bill Beavis, Interim Director of the Plant Sciences Institute at Iowa State University, the George F. Sprague Endowed Chair and Professor of Agronomy there as well. Professor Beavis, Bill, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for coming in. Now, explain this to us. How does this happen? How do scientists get certain genetic characteristics inserted into a crop, for instance?
Well, I wish I could say that scientists had sort of dreamed that up on them by themselves, that there was some sort of clever human ingenuity in all this. But it turns out that bacteria have been doing this sort of thing probably since bacteria arose over a billion years ago. So I think scientists sort of observed this and said, gee, you know, bacteria seem to be able to exchange their DNA between each other, and not only that, but they seem to do this, what is referred to as horizontal or lateral gene transfer to other species. And so why shouldn't we try to do the same thing?
Mm-hmm. And what is it? Help me understand the relationship between bacteria and the crop, the species.
Well, let me sort of the easiest way to say this is this lateral gene transfer, of course, is what viruses do all the time. That's how they take over your body. They insert their own, not DNA, but RNA, and they take things over. So in a sense, bacteria do this in plants quite often. And what you might think about is that nature is attacking or bombarding the genomes of all organisms, mm-hmm. and they do this all the time.
And changing them inevitably.
Right. So we tend to have this sort of view of genomes within a species as being some sort of fixed set of genetic variants that we recombine through breeding or crossing, and so we just sort of shuffle this fixed set around. But the truth of the matter is the bacteria are constantly, inserting their genes into various species, plants included. And now, for the most part, such transposons are typically silenced. We have the ability to silence these foreign bits of DNA through what we often refer to as epigenetic mechanisms. And of course, originally we sort of viewed these epigenetic or these foreign bits of DNA or these transposons that were silenced as we sort of derided them as being called junk DNA. Now, in humans, it turns out that about 40% of our genome consists of these transposons. Soybean, which is important in this state, 60% of its genome, about 60% of its genome, appears to be consist of transposons. And in corn, it's about 85%. Now, occasionally, what happens, and this relates to your Monday show, occasionally the genome goes through some sort of shock. It experiences some sort of unusual environment or some other, let's just call it a genomic shock right now. And these transposons, these bits of DNA from other species, often bacteria, become activated. They're no longer silenced. Your Freaks of Nature show on Monday, guest sort of talked about how this sort of thing happens and what the consequences of it are. Now, the beauty of this, of course, is that it gives organisms a way to adapt to changing environments. This is sort of how we evolve.
So, to cut to the focus of our show, the way we've learned to genetically modify crops is to induce this genomic shock and do it so that we change a characteristic in it. But we're essentially doing something that has happened in nature for millions of years.
That's right. Yeah, as I said, I wish I could say that this were some cleverness, some human cleverness. What we're really trying to do is mimic. Now, the people who do this, of course, would argue that they spend a lot of time trying to optimize this so that they optimize the transformation event and that it's not just such a random process and that they, in fact, don't have their gene silenced. Mm-hmm. But essentially, that's what's going on. And quite often, we even use bacteria to do this. In soybean, we use a bacterium called Agrobacterium to carry out this process.
So it sounds like, and the way you've described it, it sounds very non-threatening, far, far away from the description of Frankenfoods or Frankencrops and things like that. You must disagree with those descriptions.
Well, you know, I don't know that I disagree with those. I think we just need to put it in the context of what goes on in nature all the time. Not all activity that happens in nature is beneficial to us, and that would also be the case here. We really do need to evaluate whether or not these transformation events are going to be beneficial or if they're going to have the side effects. So
Do we understand, for instance, when we change a genome, how it affects the plant as a system, as a whole?
Typically, I would say we have some sense of how it does that. If I were to do this on a soybean plant or a corn plant, I would then start growing that plant and look for all sorts of phenotypes, if you will, abnormal behavior. But, you know, at the molecular level, we're just beginning to understand that. And we're not real sure yet how to control for what would be sort of the normal behavior of transposons moving around and what would be the behavior of the transgenic, the engineered event.
Okay. Professor Bill Beavis with us, Interim Director of the Plant Sciences Institute at Iowa State University. And Bill, please stay with us. Be with us through the hour. We want to turn now to Jerry Peckham. Jerry farms. He's a corn and soybean producer who lives near Jefferson in west central Iowa, joining us by phone. Good afternoon to you, Jerry.
Yeah, good afternoon to you.
Been listening to this conversation we've been having with Professor Beavis. What has been your experience working with GM crops? Do you use them?
Well, yeah, we use them. I was a rather slow adopter of the Roundup Ready genetic modification, but I use both that, and then I also use crops that have been genetically modified for insect protection.
Mm-hmm. What benefits do you get from GM crops?
Well, the Roundup Ready or glyphosate-resistant crops, I think, have benefited me from lowering my total usage of herbicide and and probably increasing my profits because of the lower cost of the herbicide program, even with a tech fee.
Mm-hmm. So how much fewer herbicides do you find you're using?
Well, at first we were only using glyphosate. Now we are starting to manage for potential glyphosate resistance, and now we're going back and using more herbicides, just not near as much as we had in the past.
Do you notice any difference working with GM crops when you watch them grow in the fields, their look, their feel? You have to farm them differently with machinery?
No, I don't see a lot of difference. One major difference is that the corn that's been modified to resist insects seems to resist a lot of bacteria, and the stalks do not break down very fast. Mm. We have a lot more stalks in the fields over 2 or 3 years. So you'll see a lot of stalks in our soybean fields at the end of the soybean season from the previous year of corn.
Mm, and that can cause problems because you're rotating crops often, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. It's good and it's bad. It's good because it protects the soil longer, but then it's also harder to deal with. And I mentioned that I think that the glyphosate crops have probably been profitable. I'm not so sure about the insect resistance. It seems to me that a lot of times those crops just barely pay for the technology fee.
Mm, okay. And I understand you're concerned a little bit about the potential health impacts from eating GMO foods. Quickly, we have about a minute before we go to break, but share with us what your thinking is there. Why are you concerned?
Well, I think that we haven't done enough basic research in universities. I think the public should have access to the basic research. I think it should be financed by the public because I think we tend to rush products to the market too quickly, and we're not really sure about the long-term effects, both to human health and to the health of the planet, really. Mm.
Let's get a quick response from Bill Beavis at Iowa State University. Do you hear that concern often? How are you answering it there at the Plant Sciences Institute, Bill Beavis?
Well, we didn't hear all of the answer, but I think I got the gist of it, that the suggestion was that some more research needs to be done on the consequences of any of these transgenic events, and it should be conducted in the public domain. And I guess I would agree with that. It needs to be paid for, of course. And therein lies the challenge, is how do we pay for these evaluations by an organization that has no financial commitments to any particular organization in terms of the outcome.
Okay, we'll talk further when we continue our discussion about the debate over GM crops. Professor Bill Beavis with us of Iowa State University. Jerry Peckham with us, a farmer from near Jefferson in west central Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, we'll be joined by the 2001 World Food Prize laureate, Dr. Per Pinstrup Andersen, live by phone from Denmark. We'd like you to join our conversation as well this hour. What are your thoughts and questions about genetically modified crops? Do GM crops play a role in your work? Do you have experience working with them? What are your hopes and fears concerning GM crops and foods? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Back in 1 minute. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today talking about what's at stake for Iowa in the debate over genetically modified crops. Talking this hour specifically because we did do this yesterday. We thought it was warranted a tandem of shows. Science and business of working with GMOs, today with William Beavis, Bill Beavis, a professor at Iowa State University at the Plant Sciences Institute. And before we go to our World Food Prize laureate, I wanted to make sure we'd answered Jerry Peckham's concern about the potential health impacts, because I know this is something a lot of listeners tune into, that we need to have. Jerry, did that sufficiently answer your question, Bill Beavis's answer there about reassure you that there's enough testing being done?
Well, yeah, I'm concerned about the long-term impact, and I don't think we've had enough experience with some of these events to know what the long-term impact is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Bill Beavis, would you agree? A lot of unknowns out there. We just have to, in certain cases, take our chances.
Well, certainly your guest yesterday talked about this a little bit, but I tend to agree with Jerry. what is the long term? And really what we want to answer are questions about multi-generation impacts. We already know that through epigenetic activities, the environment that I encounter may show up in my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren in terms of altering their genome. And I think, you know, we need to start thinking seriously about how exactly to run those kind of controlled tests using model organisms.
Okay, let's introduce another guest into our program. Dr. Per Pinstrup Andersen joins us by phone from Denmark, and he is the 2001 World Food Prize laureate, the H.E. Babcock Professor of Food Nutrition and Public Policy in the Division of Nutritional Sciences, and the J. Thomas Clark Professor of Entrepreneurship at Cornell College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at Cornell University. Quite a long introduction there. Dr. Professor Pinstrup Andersen, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Let's go back to one of the reasons we're doing this show. What do you make of the EU's decision? You're in an EU country right now to allow countries to make their own decisions about growing GMO crops.
Well, I think it would be great if the EU could make that decision jointly. But the silver lining of that cloud, of course, is that the EU members do not seem to be able to agree on how to proceed. And if they cannot have what they call a qualified majority, then it is up to the EU Commission to make decisions about these things. And the Commission has just decided to allow the import of, I believe, four genetically modified corn varieties. So in a way, this may be a rule and divide kind of thing, but it would be nice if the EU countries could agree to deal with this problem.
We've heard that the U.S. Trade Representative is against this move. What does this move mean for Iowa's agriculture, being an agricultural state, to potentially mean as well?
Well, presumably what it means is that some countries will have the possibility of not importing genetically modified grain that has been approved elsewhere. But honestly, I don't know for sure what it's going to mean because it's so new. It would be best if the Commission decision would be true for all countries, but I'm not sure whether it is.
So in looking at Iowa's exports of corn and beans to the EU and the rest of the world, as far as the EU 27 member countries go, we could be looking at, if this goes through, a patchwork of acceptance or non-acceptance of certain crops grown in the state.
That would be about the next to the worst outcome. The worst outcome, of course, would be if the EU altogether decides not to import genetically modified grain, which they won't do, I'm sure. So the honest answer is, at this point, I don't know. I don't think the dust has really settled as to what this means.
Can you set this latest chapter in context for us about the ongoing debate, the difference between the way the Europeans have seen it compared to the United States, and how this debate over the use of GMOs has evolved?
Well, it all started going wrong when a group of advocacy and non-governmental organizations decided that they were going to go up against genetic import of genetically modified grain to the European countries. These non-governmental organizations, including Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, and a few others, decided to make this a case so that they would oppose genetically modified food into Europe, and one could suspect that that was in part a way of raising funds for the for a new course of these non-governmental organizations, because at the time they didn't really have a strong course. The nuclear power issue was kind of off the agenda, and there wasn't really much to protest against. So here was something they could really get their teeth into. Particularly since, of course, it was a private corporation, it was Monsanto that was behind some of that, and that would add some opposition from individuals who basically opposed to large-scale private corporations.
Mm-hmm. And at a grassroots level, is the European population just generally less predisposed to this type of new technologies. I suppose we could trace that in American history. Americans tend to jump on technological advances very quickly. The Europeans, more reticent, more cautious.
Well, I'm not sure that's really true, because prior to the non-governmental organization's successful campaign against genetically engineered food, the Europeans were just as positive towards genetic engineering for food and agriculture as the Americans were. And it was really, I think, a situation where many Europeans said, look, we don't really need this. We have enough food. We are well fed. And it sounds like there might be some risks. We don't know what those risks are. Neither could anybody else tell us what they were. But come on, why take any even virtual risk when we don't need the stuff? And I think that's kind of the position that many of the Europeans took.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that this debate we're having in the so-called first world could be seen as a luxury, and other countries, developing countries, cannot afford this debate? Need to feed their hungry.
This is a key issue you're raising, because many of the developing countries need productivity increases in agriculture. They need to protect their crops from insects and from droughts and from other things that happen, plant diseases and so on. And they desperately need more agricultural research to make this happen. And that research, in some cases, will include genetic engineering. And because the leaders of a number of developing countries, many of those in Africa, are looking to the Europeans and saying, look, if this is too risky for the Europeans, we're not going to permit it in our countries either. And the very low income, the very poor family that's trying to feed its children, will lose the crop next time the insects come around, because they can't afford pesticides, and the genetically modified insect-resistant crop varieties are not available to them. Take the case of Kenya, which has just gone through a major drought, and thousands of kids died of starvation because the Kenyan farmers did not have access to drought-tolerant crop varieties. Corn varieties is really what we're talking about. Now Kenya is permitting some field testing of genetically modified corn varieties, but this is at least 10 years too late. The kids are dying for totally unnecessarily. So yes, what we are doing in Europe may serve us, because we will not go hungry, but we need to differentiate what we need and what the low-income people in low-income countries need. The problems are very different.
Mm-hmm.
We suffer from health problems, and we are using genetically engineered medicine to solve our health problems. We're not questioning that. And the Africans need to solve their health problems, frequently hunger and malnutrition.
Okay, very good. Please stay with us. 2001 World Food Prize laureate Dr. Per Pinstrup Andersen joining us from Denmark this afternoon. Also with us, Professor Bill Beavis of Iowa State University's Plant Sciences Institute. Jerry Peckham with us, a farmer from near Jefferson in west central Iowa. John Gilbert, we haven't heard from him. He's on the line, a farmer also near Iowa Falls in north central Iowa. We'll hear from him when we come back. We'd like to hear from you as well. What are your thoughts and questions about genetically modified crops? Do they play a role in your work, your hopes, fears, and concerns? How GM crops and foods impact Iowa this hour on the Exchange? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or the Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes. It's the Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The large majority of Iowa seniors say if they need long-term care, they want to live at home as long as possible. Tomorrow on this program, over the noon hour, we discuss the long-term care options open to seniors. We'll also meet 100-year-old Mildred Pierce of Cedar Falls. She's lived in the same house for 74 years. That's tomorrow on The Exchange as we talk long-term care options open to seniors. Today we're talking about what's at stake for Iowa in the debate over genetically modified crops, the second of two programs we've been doing on that this week. Today focusing on the science and business of working with GMOs. Our guests, we're honored to have Dr. Per Pinstrup Andersen joining us from Denmark by phone, the 2001 World Food Prize laureate. Delighted to have with us as well Bill Beavis, professor at Iowa State University at the Plant Sciences Institute, the interim director there. Also joining us, a couple of food producers, farmers. Jerry Peckham was with us from near Jefferson in west central Iowa, and also someone we haven't talked to yet, we want to talk to right now, John Gilbert, a farmer, a producer, I understand, of hogs and dairy near Iowa Falls in north central Iowa. Good afternoon to you, John.
Good afternoon. I'm glad to be here.
You've been listening on to our conversation, I take it. So what has your experience been with GM crops? Do you use any?
We have to raise a few glyphosate-resistant beans because our preference is to raise non-GMOs, and there's sometimes a limit to how many contracts we can get for specialty beans.
Mm-hmm.
We use the bulk of our corn for feed. And since we consume the food that we raise here, some of the food that we raise here, we have concerns about using engineered corn and as feed. We have experimented with a couple varieties. We have not, in our experience, found that the claims that are being made for it panned out. We have a number of concerns about the whole system. Primarily, our biggest concern is similar to Jerry's. There has just not been enough science done on the safety of these crops, particularly for use as feed. The history of the problems at the FDA and the shoddy research that's been done just ought to keep anybody concerned enough to want a lot more basic testing done, and particularly by third parties.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just looking. Tell us more about your suspicions. You sound like, the wool's been pulled over your eyes, or is in this case. What is the basis of this? Do you have some studies you can point to that are the basis of your concerns?
Well, let's start with this. A number of years ago, we had some cattle in pasture in the fall, and the grass was getting short. And, you'd have a couple that want to crawl through the fence once in a while, and you'd put them back in. And the neighbor at the time was picking corn, and you walk through the field chasing the heifer back in, and there's an ear of corn laying there, so you just pick it up and throw it in the pasture, assuming that that's something more for them to eat, keep them happy, and it's going to be a day or two until you can get them moved, so you want them to stay there for a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
And you come back 2 or 3 days later, and that ear of corn's still laying there.
They don't eat it.
They won't eat it.
Hmm.
And
how do you explain that?
Well, it's different, and they can tell a difference. And we know from our experience, because we do farm near some wooded area, that livestock has a different preference for what.
Just because they have a different preference, we also have dogs and cats. You buy them a new cat food or a new dog food, they might not eat it, but it doesn't mean it's worse for them, does it?
Well, when I've chopped silage, I was chopping for a neighbor once, and we were chopping GM corn, and it didn't smell right. I could tell, when you chop corn, there's a distinctive smell, a lot like you get when you husk sweet corn.
Mm-hmm.
And that smell wasn't there, and I'm assuming that, the livestock can tell a difference. And
okay.
I'm not saying that there isn't anything good for them there, but we do know from experience that since what we're feeding corn, we pay a lot more attention to the nutritive content, that you can have quite a bit of variation in nutrients, and so we're pretty specific about what we want to feed.
Very good. A lot of people want to get into our conversation. Great concern that you brought up here, John Gilbert. Before we do go to our callers, and do join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. I want to get a reaction to that experience on the ground, an Iowa farmer, Professor Bill Beavis of Iowa State University. What do you make of his concerns?
Well, I think that it's these kinds of observations that are that need to be followed up on. So, you know, like both of the producers on your producer guests on this call-in, I agree. There needs to be, you know, as one of them said, a third-party evaluation of all of the possible changes that are going on, and it needs to be done under very controlled conditions. So that, you know, it's not some other thing, that some other environmental component that is actually the causative agent.
Mm-hmm. But another criticism here has been to do with the independence of research institutions, mm-hmm. which rely on funding from companies that produce these GMOs, Monsanto and Pioneer. Now, how do we guard against undue influence for instance, your Plant Sciences Institute?
Yeah, so our institute is funded entirely by taxpayer support, either through extramural funding from the federal funding agencies or from the state taxpayers of Iowa. The difficulty we have in seeking funding for the type of thing that our producers are asking for is that those kinds of tests are not viewed as fundamental basic research. They're viewed as applied research. And it's very difficult to get these kinds of applied research dollars from, you know, the various funding agencies at this point in time. That doesn't mean that it can't change, and it should change. And I think, you know, we owe it to the taxpayers to conduct these what some would call applied tests.
Okay, let's go back to our calls. Ken is joining us from Fairfield. Good afternoon, Ken. Thank you for joining our discussion here on The Exchange.
Good. Thank you for taking my call. I publish a monthly newsletter called the Organic and Non-GMO Report, and I've covered the GM food issue for the last 10 years. And one point I wanted to make is that with so much Roundup being used with Roundup Ready crops in the U.S., that weeds are becoming resistant to Roundup. This is a growing problem. It started in the South, and it's now spreading to the Midwest. I believe there's some 22 weeds that are resistant to Roundup. And this is causing farmers to use more herbicides, which is undermining the purpose of the Roundup Ready GM crop system. And I've also interviewed a couple of scientists, Robert Kramer, who works for the USDA, and Don Huber at Purdue. And they've published research showing some negative impacts from Roundup on beneficial soil bacteria and also increasing plant diseases such as Fusarium fungi.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to our farmer, Jerry Peckham, near Jefferson in west central Iowa. Jerry, in using GM crops, have you seen weed resistance that it's being described here?
Well, I haven't seen it in our crops yet, but as I mentioned earlier, we're concerned about it and we're managing for it. We are using a little bit more herbicide than we have in the past because we're using several herbicides at very low levels.
Okay, very good. Let's talk a little bit more about Ken. Thank you very much. Do you have another point?
No, that was it.
Thank you. Ken joining us from Fairfield. Join our discussion. Your thoughts and questions about genetically modified crops, the impact that they're having on our lives here in Iowa, their safety, the business of working with them if you work in the agricultural sector. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Also, email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Also with us, Per Pinstrup Andersen joining us from Denmark, the 2001 World Food Prize laureate. Let's go to this concern. Can I put this one to you, Professor Pinstrup Andersen? Do you have concerns about corporations like Monsanto and Pioneer Hybrid owning the patents on seed technology so that they dominate the landscape? You can't very well be a farmer unless you are buying from Monsanto or Pioneer Hybrid.
I don't have any problems with the corporations and the research institutions that develop the technology. That I have no problems with they having exclusive rights for a period of time. I think that's the only way you can get the new technology developed. But I do want to add that and I'm particularly concerned about low-income farmers in developing countries, and they need publicly funded research. And remember that the Green Revolution was extremely successful on the basis of publicly funded research, where the where the intellectual property rights were not exercised by the institutions. But I think to tell Monsanto that they cannot take exclusive rights to what they develop is the same as to tell them stop doing research. That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever if you're interested in meeting future food needs and reducing hunger in developing countries and for that matter elsewhere. So, no, I have no problems with that. I do have a problem with the very limited public sector investment, the very limited public investment in agricultural research. And that goes both for the U.S., the support of U.S. Institutions, universities, and otherwise, as well as developing country institutions. I think we need much more public money into research, and that way we don't have the issue of intellectual property rights.
What specific area of research you think is underfunded, say at Iowa State University or another university that focuses on agricultural production?
Well, in we need much more research to get ready for the climate change that is already happening. We need research that will help farmers fight new insects, new plant diseases, that will fight the droughts and the floods that we're seeing right now. We have droughts in Russia. We have droughts in Ukraine and Kazakhstan. We have floods in Pakistan. We need crop varieties that will produce something during drought periods. And again, while I'm not so worried about Russia, although maybe we should be, I'm worried about the small farmer in West Africa that loses her crop when the drought hits and the kids die of starvation. And it's that kind of pragmatic thinking that I think we need to introduce into the debate about using genetically modified food and agriculture. These people desperately need solutions. And yes, it would be interesting to wait several generations to make sure that there isn't a negative effect associated with this. But last year, 5 million kids died from hunger and malnutrition. There was no issue there. They died. They don't have a future. So it seems to me that we need to weigh the benefits against the risks.
2001 World Food Prize laureate Per Pinstrup Andersen joining us live by phone from Denmark today. And I'd like to get a reaction to that from Bill Beavis, because he is the interim director at the Plant Sciences Institute at Iowa State University. Now, this is interesting about the climate change. Is there work going on at the Plant Sciences Institute at ISU that looks at how our crops need to change as our climate is changing globally?
Yes, there is quite a bit work. And in fact, that may be, across the, not just Plant Sciences Institute, but across the agricultural sciences at Iowa State, that is sort of number one on everybody's mind. I agree with Pierre. There is woefully little funding to support this sort of research. And to give you an idea, the U.S. Department of Agricultural extramural funding program puts out, on the order of $400 million a year. Now, that's for all crops and all animal species across the board. The National Institutes, to give a comparison, the National Institutes of Health, which basically addresses human disease problems, puts out about $35 billion, with a B, dollars per year. Our as Pierre just pointed out, human health in the developing world is first and foremost about producing enough food. So, if you can't feed somebody, you certainly can't deal with HIV/AIDS. So I think, we have this unfortunate imbalance in our funding research that exists in the United States right now. And apparently in Europe also.
And with research not funded to the extent that you think it needs to be, the danger there is we go forward and we're blind to a certain extent because we don't know all that we could have known about GMOs.
Right. And instead of dealing with prevention, maybe the GMOs are causing some of our human health problems, but instead of dealing with the prevention, we're dealing with the disease after the fact. It's part of the reason why our health insurance is so expensive in this country is because we're dealing with the problem after the fact.
Okay, let's get to our callers. 1-866-780-9100 if you want to weigh in on this debate about GM crops. The exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Let's go to Charlie. Charlie's in Des Moines. Welcome to our program, Charlie.
Hi. Well, I've spent a good part of my adult life, over 20 years, trying to find out what foods I'm allergic to. And I'll just take dairy, and am I allergic to dairy, or am I allergic to some effect that was caused by the growth hormone that's been fed to cows? You see what I'm saying? I mean, when you're trying to evaluate what's wrong with you health-wise and find out it's related to your food, it doesn't matter if an insect has caused a change in the genomes or it's caused by us. It's a change. How can you evaluate it? How much research and development is done out in the field by us eating it and then discover that it's wrong?
Yeah. And there's
a problem. I don't want to eat any GMO foods, but then if I find that that's a problem, if I go to a restaurant, I go to a store, and I'm trying to find out what kind of wheat or corn was in the product that I'm buying, it's almost impossible.
Right, right.
I have to give up eating certain things because I can't find out the source of the product.
I understand your concerns, Charlie. With so many variables in our lives, who knows what causes a food allergy? It's hard to pin that down in any one individual sometimes. Charlie from Des Moines, thank you very much for joining us. Let's go to Ames with Dan. Dan, hi. Welcome to our program. Just a few minutes left of our hour. What have you got on your mind?
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call. I'm with the Council for Agricultural Science and Technology, where we publish research such as this. And it seems like a constant refrain in what's been said by all parties is that there's not enough research, not enough objective research. With the barrage of information, I was wondering if Dr. Pinstrup Anderson or Professor Beavis could point out who and where we can get information now. It seems crucial that with what's going on in the world and with feeding the vast amount of people that need the farm produce, that we get answers as soon as possible. Do they know of any sources for objective science-based information that they trust?
Okay, let's go to Dr. Pinstrup Anderson in Denmark. What is the best source for objective information on GMOs?
Well, the best source, I think, is in fact the U.S. and the European universities. I mean, that's where you get the most objective information. And, of course, I'm biased because I work at Cornell University, but it seems to me that that's where you go first. The UN, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, is very good at making available statistics on all kinds of things, and you can certainly get some information from there. There is an international organization in Washington called the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI for short, and again they do a lot of research, but that's more on the food policy side. But they will have lots of information as well. But can I just make another comment on what we were just talking about? Last month the wheat prices jumped by 50%. That is, the global wheat prices went up by 50% during a month. I don't think we've seen that for a very, very long time. And the main reason is the speculation that because Russia has a severe drought, the wheat harvest in Russia and a few other places, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Pakistan, and Canada, and so on, will have a lower production. We desperately need to find a way of dealing with the volatility in production caused in part by climate change, And the way to deal with that, it seems to me, is in part by investing in the kind of research that we were just talking about. So this is really urgent, and that's why I'm very concerned when my colleagues in this program want to kind of hold back until we know what's happening to our great-grandchildren, because we really don't have any good hypotheses we can test right now in our research as to what the negative health effects would be of transgenic food. And if we don't have good hypotheses, it's very difficult to do good research. So I was taken aback a bit by this resistance to genetic engineering in food and agriculture because of the potential health risk. I just don't see any indications that these risks are there.
Okay, thank you very much, Per Pinstrup Anderson, 2001 World Food Prize laureate. Let's end the program. Just a couple minutes left. I want to go to our people on the ground, Jerry Peckham, John Gilbert, farmers in Iowa. Very quickly, Jerry, can you tell us what would you like to see in terms of research? You use GM crops.
Well, I'd like to see a publicly funded public research on the health effects of on humans, but also, just as importantly, we're releasing a lot of genetic material into the environment, and how is that going to affect the environment?
Okay, John Gilbert, few seconds for you, please.
Well, I think I want to conclude by saying, you know, I think that we're really having a problem with diversity out here. We're losing it rapidly, and it is affecting the choices that the consumer has. And I really think that, you know, we need to not lose sight of the fact that our choices for the consumer are at risk here.
Okay, very good. We'll leave it there. A lot of questions, a lot of unknowns, a lot of research needing to be done. That's research that's already been done at, for instance, Iowa State University, the Plant Sciences Institute. We have been pleased to have Bill Beavis, the interim director of that, with us. Thank you very much, Bill.
Sure. Ben, may I suggest that people go to another
quickly
location? It's called Biosafety Institute for Genetically Modified Agricultural Products, Big Map. I think that they also are an organization that provides genetic information or research information on
Very
this.
Good. Thank you, Bill. Dr. Per Pinstrup Andersen from Denmark, thank you so much, sir, for taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure.
The 2001 World Food Prize laureate, Per Pinstrup Andersen, Jerry Peckham, John Gilbert, thank you for giving us the view from the ground in the fields in Iowa as we've looked at the debate over genetically modified crops. The theme music for our program is composed and performed by Dan Knight. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk show is Jeff Schmidt. Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer are producers. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ben Kiefer.